Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
In the small village of Isle Brewers in Somerset, England, on the 19th of May 1680, Mrs. Mary Herring, the wife of a farm labourer, gave birth to conjoined twins, an event known at the time as a monstrous birth. Twin daughters Aquila and Priscilla became instant celebrities, put on display in their home for hundreds of visitors and providing much-needed income to their struggling parents. Within a matter of weeks, the children had been abducted with the intent to show them around the country for profit. So begins the heartbreaking story of one of the earliest examples of exploitation and the exhibition of physical difference in England. It's a story of public display without consent, both before and after death. Today I'm joined by Dr. Whitney Dirks, author of Monstrosity, Bodies and Knowledge in Early Modern England, A Curiosity to See and Behold. We'll be talking about the lives of the Herring twins and the legality of human ownership in a culture which celebrated the spectacle of difference. And a brief content warning before we begin. Our conversation includes the use of historic terminology, such as monstrous births. While this was common in the 17th century, I want to acknowledge that it does not reflect our own thoughts and is included only in the context of representing the past accurately. I would also like to advise that this episode includes mention of infant death and other themes which listeners may find distressing. Dr. Dirks, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Now, we're going to be talking about some material that's quite difficult. And one of the things that might be particularly difficult for listeners is some of the words that are used, the language of unusual bodies that is typical of the 17th century, words like ill-shapen, alien, monstrous. What do these terms mean? And what do they tell us about historic views on difference?
The most common words and phrases that show up in my research are monster and monstrous birth. Those are referring to physically unusual humans and animals, such as conjoined twins. And the terms were intended in a descriptive manner in the 17th and 18th centuries. But there's clearly a pejorative element at play here. The humans and animals that are the subject of my study were largely explained in terms of God's will and or the internal workings of nature. And so there was an understanding that sometimes a pregnancy doesn't result in the infant that you expect. And people were looking for explanations. This is a human universal. We're always trying to explain the world around us. And again, the most common explanations were either this is God's will. He is sending usually a message or a warning to the people of England or to the people of Europe against sin broadly and sometimes specific sins, depending on the author who is writing about it. and also the possibility that the normal course of nature has fallen apart in some way, whether this is by actions that occurred during pregnancy. There is a good amount of blaming the pregnant mother for what happens to the infant in utero. This is referred to as maternal impression, the idea that women's thoughts are very dangerous and can impress themselves on the fetus. And there was also the idea that as an entity, embodied nature is working out God's plan, but that periodically something goes wrong in the process. And so at least in the late 17th and early 18th century at the Royal Society of London, an early natural philosophical or early scientific society, they were trying to catalog and, to a lesser extent, explain why, when things go wrong with nature, that can tell us more about the way that everything was supposed to happen in the first place. So the terms monster, monstrous birth, ill-shapen, deformed are definitely problematic from a modern perspective. But they also don't neatly map onto a modern definition of disability. And while I definitely explain the terms I use, I largely retain the original language.
Now, one of the major stories that comes out of your book is that of the Herring twins. What can you tell me about their birth?
The Herring twins were born in May of 1680 in far rural Somerset, which is in the southwest of England, in a tiny village. And they were born to a very poor set of parents, Mary and Richard Herring, who already had perhaps three other children at the time. And Mary had been sick for a long time before the birth. The parents wildly in debt. And they gave birth to Priscilla and Aquila Herring, a pair of conjoined twins who were fully duplicated through the body and connected through the torso.
And hundreds of people flocked to see Aquila and Priscilla in their first few weeks of life and gave money to those impoverished parents as they did so. How common was this monetization of what they referred to as monstrous births?
The monetization was actually fairly common. We have a lot of evidence of it happening. We know from gaps in the historical record that this couldn't have happened with every, for example, pair of conjoined twins that was born. But there is a lot of evidence of both intentionally putting people on show, or sometimes individuals as adults putting themselves on show. And there is, at least in the case of Priscilla and Aquila Herring, a lot of evidence that this sort of curiosity about the birth gave rise to a culture in which people decided to show up at this house. There's no evidence that suggests that the parents began this endeavor by intending to make money off of the twins. It seems as though people in first the village, then the region, then across Somerset decided to travel to see these twins and in the process left some money behind with the parents. As it turns out, that was a hugely lucrative endeavor. The parents were making perhaps £5 per day, which would have been at the time about a third of an annual salary for Richard Herring, who was an agricultural laborer. So it became, again, incredibly lucrative, but I don't believe that was the parents' intent in the first place.
In other words, all these people turning up to see the twins tells us something about unusual bodies being seen somehow as public property, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. There were certainly laws about things like labor, that you could not sign a child over into apprenticeship before age 7. Scholars have shown quite convincingly that there were no laws prohibiting slavery. But the question of ownership or kind of communal property of these conjoined twins is very fuzzy. And so definitely there was a sense among visitors to the house that they maybe deserved is too strong a word, but they had some right to be there, and giving the parents money in exchange was an acceptable behavior.
Didn't notions of consent ever come into play?
It's complicated. Parents could sign their own children up into apprenticeships. When we're talking about neonates such as Aquila and Priscilla, certainly there was no consent on behalf of the children. There are a number of cases across Europe of people who purchased or otherwise obtained children from their parents for the purposes of putting them on display. The consent seems to lie on behalf of the parents, and we just don't have a lot of evidence outside of actual accusations of slavery. We don't have a lot of evidence of consent on behalf of the individuals on show. Or perhaps I should better put it that individuals who ended up on show as adults generally had also been on show as children, and the whole thing may have been normalized by the time they were old enough to be able to give consent to the process.
It's obvious in a case involving newborns that we don't have any evidence telling us about their reaction to it, their interiority. But if we consider other cases where the children involved are older, do we have any evidence at all of their reactions to their treatment?
Yes. The best case study out of my own research for this question occurs in 1685, when an East Indian man, so he is from the Indian subcontinent, he has contracted with the ship's captain, Sir Thomas Grantham, to come to England for 6 months to go on show. The man's name is Shek Shun. And he has a parasitic twin connected to his body in his torso. It consists of the head and most of the torso and limbs of what appears to be an infant coming out of his abdomen. And after having been in England for more than a year, Shek Shun shows up in the Court of King's Bench, which is one of the London legal courts. And the documents we have from this case are of newsletter accounts describing the case. I've been unsuccessful in trying to find any actual legal documents from it. In those newsletter accounts, and there are two of them, in both, the man Shek Shun claims that he has been kept like a slave beyond the period when he had contracted to come to England for 6 months. The legal cases themselves are not actually about his legal status, whether as a slave or otherwise. They are that he has been taken into custody by a local sheriff, Sir Thomas Grantham, that ship's captain, is suing to get Shek Shun back into his custody, to essentially regain the bodies that had been lost. And the accounts of the legal case, so these newsletters, say that Shek Shun had been baptized since arriving in England. And this leads into a couple of late 17th century and 18th century beliefs. There was the general sense that England is too free an air for slaves. And this goes back to a 16th century legal case, but it's very clear, and modern legal scholars in the last 5 years or so have made a lot of very convincing arguments in the direction that slavery was actually fully legal in England prior to the late 18th century, when it was explicitly disallowed throughout the British Empire. And there seems to be no question of whether Grantham can petition, sue to get the body, to get Shek Shun's body back to him. And despite the fact that there was a widespread belief that Christians could not enslave other Christians, that too was actually fully legal. And so Shek Shun ran away several times and eventually disappears out of the documentary record. Presumably, he ran away successfully at that point, but we have no evidence or at least not on the English side of the records, whether he might have successfully returned to India.
Now, I don't suppose there was anything particularly new about displaying human beings for profit in this period, but there is something new in terms of how it is being popularized, which is, of course, mass producing print media for the first time. How is print involved in drawing attention to these people?
Print is involved both broadly in terms of distributing knowledge about humans and animals with disparate physical features, in terms of various forms of cheap print, so cheaply printed books and pamphlets and broadsides and ballads that anyone across the socioeconomic scale could purchase. And so they were described in kind of the precursors to newspapers. So the knowledge about monsters and monstrous births was very widespread. In terms of display itself, we know that there were also advertising leaflets produced in order to assert that, in one case, quote, the hermaphrodite is here to be seen. And in fact, that printed advertising leaflet is describing a painted lantern with those words on it that is hung outside of the location where that individual was on show. And people were commonly put on show in pubs and coffee houses and at various of the annual fairs around London. Some individuals, if aiming at a higher quality clientele, put themselves on show or were put on show in private apartments, for example, in Piccadilly or some of the other often West End neighborhoods. And so printing was both an advertising medium and a larger informational medium. The period I study ends about 1800, and so this is before the rise of what we think of as freak shows in the 19th century. And so everything was a bit more ad hoc rather than a single organized exhibition of many unusual humans and animals that would often in the 19th century also include people of different ethnicities from around the world.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned ephemeral literature, and one of the things about this cheap ephemeral literature is that it's intended for people of limited literacy, and it is full of pictures, woodcuts, or engravings. And I wonder what this tells us about the demand not only for public exhibition, but for prolonged private consumption of unusual bodies.
So we know from the broader woodcut publications, they could be hung on walls as actual decoration in pubs and even in private houses. We also know that on the exact opposite end of the socioeconomic spectrum, that of the nobility and royalty, that the bodies in England, particularly of court dwarfs, were painted, that often featured the individual, so the dwarf or little person who was part of the court of the noble or the royal, but also to a large extent was owned by that individual. And these were a form of conspicuous consumption. The best example of this in England is Queen Henrietta Maria, who was the wife of Charles I of England. She had a menagerie that included a number of birds, and she had a bunch of dogs, and she had a monkey named Pug, and she also had a young dwarf named Geoffrey Hudson, who was first gifted to one of Charles's courtiers when the dwarf was 7 years old, and then subsequently gifted to Queen Henrietta Maria, and became a living doll in her court. He was, for much of his life, 18 inches tall. He was very well proportioned, and she treated him as a member of her court. He became a courtier, but he definitely didn't hold the status, even when he became an adult, of being one of her real adult courtiers. He was still largely viewed in a childlike manner, and we have some evidence that he didn't like this as he got older. And so the portraits that Henrietta Maria had created of Geoffrey Hudson, there are perhaps half a dozen or so extant that have survived to today, and we know that more were created. And so this memorialization, although he was still alive, so this conspicuous consumption, really, of this unusual member of her court, who was also a member of her menagerie, these portraits were clearly a way of proving the quality of her possessions, really. Again, conspicuous consumption.
What is the nature of the evidence that we have of his own perspectives on this?
We do not have any sort of autobiography from him. We have a few documents that talk about a duel that he was in which he apparently was a crack shot with a pistol and killed another man over an insult to his height and or body. And Hudson was then disgraced. This was after Henrietta Maria had fled to France during the English Civil War. And Geoffrey was sent back to England and ultimately didn't get there. He got weirdly captured by pirates and ended up in Barbary slavery for about 2 decades and eventually got back to England. And we only know this because he petitioned Charles II for a pension late in life. Unfortunately, most of my knowledge about Geoffrey is not out of my own research. My research focused on the portraits in which he was portrayed rather than his biography. And so I can't talk about the very specific documents in which we know that he was disgruntled about the way he was treated.
Forgive me, I went off piece because I've just got interested in what you said.
Oh no, by all means. This is what, honestly, conversations with me about my book often become, because there's just so much going on in the research.
You mentioned that there was an interest not only in human bodies, but that there were stories and representations of animals. Can you tell us more?
Yes, most of the representations of animals are of what we would today think of as farm animals or household pets. These are animals with which humans would have been in close contact. So dogs, cats, pigs, cows, sheep, that sort of thing. And there are, in the cheap literature, the human and animal conjoined twins, for example, are described in exactly the same terms. The only difference is that in some cases of human births, the parents are discussed as well in the literature and almost exclusively discussed in terms of these are good, upright, upstanding Christians who are not to blame for the event that took place. The exception to that rule is in the case of maternal impression, which I mentioned earlier, when women are blamed for things that they are perceived to have done that affected the fetus in utero. And there is also one case from the year 1600 of a young woman who has sex out of wedlock with one or perhaps two of her first cousins and gives birth to a deformed child. And in that particular case, the birth is blamed on her actions. I believe the phrase is she acted the naughty pack, so she slept around. Interestingly, it is blamed on her and not on the two first cousins, who were also very much complicit in the sex act. There are some excellent examples of animals being studied in the Royal Society of London, and these come from both society fellows who were just exposed to cases. For example, John Evelyn does not write to the society, but he does write in his diary that he was staying in an inn and a cat gave birth to kittens on his bed overnight. He apparently did not wake up because he doesn't find this out until the morning when he discovers a newborn, stillborn, two-headed kitten on his bed. So this does not become one of the articles in the Philosophical Transactions, the journal of the Royal Society, because Evelyn doesn't actually write to the society about it. But society fellows Robert Boyle heard about a colt, so a stillborn horse with a badly malformed head. The eyes were cyclopic, for example. And he travels to the farm, obtains the head, brings it back to the Royal Society, and at the next meeting, Robert Hooke, who is the curator of experiments and essentially whose job is to provide the entertainment at any given society meeting, Hooke dissects the head for the assembled audience. And that does get published about in the first few issues of the Philosophical Transactions. And also the head gets preserved for some period of time, we're not exactly sure for how long, but preserved in spirits, which Robert Boyle, who originally obtained the head, had just written a work on preserving specimens by putting them in distilled alcohol. And I believe he also then published an article in the same issue of the Transactions talking about the same thing. And so the bodies of unusual animals were certainly coveted and collected in many the same ways as those of humans, though I don't have any sort of case study equivalent to the Haring twins about any animals that might have gone on display, so I can only speak of the ways in which they were described in print. I can't really talk about how much audiences, for example, may have paid to see animals versus humans. I only have monetary information in a very limited number of instances. But generally, it was something on the order of sixpence, which would have been about half a day's wages for a laborer, to see an unusual individual on show in London.
Which is no small amount.
Yes, and the amounts went up from there. In the case of the Haring twins, it seems that people were leaving behind anything from threepence up. The higher up the socioeconomic scale you were, the more money that you left, but also it seems the more money you were expected to leave. And depending on the show in London, some of them were clearly being aimed at a much more elite audience. For example, those that started out at 2 shillings 6 pence. There was one of those that then later got dropped to a single shilling, presumably because there weren't enough people willing to pay that much money. But that is still a lot of money for a laborer. And so while these shows generally would have been aimed at a very broad audience, some of them priced individuals out.
Let's return then to the Harings. You conveyed that the family's poor status would have made them vulnerable to exploitation. What ultimately happened to the twins?
When the twins were 2 weeks old, one of two things happened. Either Richard Haring, the desperately poor father, sold them without his wife's knowledge or consent in exchange for some money, but also full support for the remainder of the family for as long as the twins lived. Or, when the twins were 2 weeks old, their local landlord, who was also the Justice of the Peace for the County of Somerset. His name is Henry Walrond. He kidnapped the twins out of an evil get-rich-quick scheme. And the ensuing legal case forms the majority of my evidence for the case study around the Herring twins. I come to the conclusion, although as any historian will tell you, history is about making arguments rather than stating facts. I conclude that it was the evil get-rich-quick scheme, but another historian looking at the identical materials could probably make a really solid argument that Richard Herring had chosen to sell his daughters. Briefly, the twins were taken out of the home by Henry Walrond, who had a document signed by Richard Herring that said Richard was giving the custody of the twins over to Walrond. This was when they were 2 weeks old. Richard had definitely signed such a document a few days prior. However, Richard claims that he was gotten drunk and not allowed to read the document. In fact, Richard says he himself was illiterate, therefore could not read it. I suspect that Richard actually was literate, which would have been unusual for a laborer in this period. But I think that he was gotten drunk and did not read the document. He was told that it said that he was asking Walrond to get a patent to show the twins around England, and instead it seems to have been a bait and switch that Richard signed a document that sold his daughters. At 2 weeks old, Henry Walrond took them out of the house. There were a lot of witnesses at the time. It seems to have been a fairly violent affair. They were taken out of their mother's arms while she cried, "Please do not tear my children asunder." And they were taken to Henry Walrond's house, where he put them on display. Then there was a small mob of villagers who showed up, and they were transferred to Montacute House, which was owned by Sir Edward Phelps, who was the other Justice of the Peace for Somerset. And they were put on display there until they died at a month old, first one twin, and then the next day, the second one. And during this time, Richard and Mary Herring were working very hard to try to get the twins back. They enlisted the help of a local gentry family, the Speaks. They got a document, probably from King's Bench, the legal court in London, although that document does not survive. But the document said, hey, you must give back the twins to their parents, which Walrond and Phelps refused to do. And then the twins died, and it began a four-year-long legal battle. Richard Herring died about 9 months into the process, so Mary Herring had to restart the legal case in her own name. At 2 years in, the judge in charge said, this has dragged out for a very long time. We need to get moving on this. And so a number of clerks were sent over to Somerset to interview witnesses. Walrond was held in contempt of court a number of times. The judge eventually threatened to throw him into Fleet Prison in London for contempt of court. Walrond eventually showed up, but then declared bankruptcy in the process. And after 4 years of extended legal wrangling, the case eventually disappears out of the legal record. And I believe Mary Herring never was paid what was due to her. The judge in the case, after about 2.5 years, said nothing about guilt, but did say that Walrond had acted very inhumanely in this matter and demanded that Mary Herring be paid all of the money that had been gained by showing the twins, that the agreement between Richard Herring and Henry Walrond be ripped up, and that the twins' bodies be returned to their mother for burial in their home parish, because 2 years into this process, they were actually still in Walrond's custody. He had them preserved or embalmed in some way, and actually had put them on show in London several months after their deaths.
So we see this court case and we see its result that there's prosecution but not conviction. What in the end then does that tell us about contemporary attitudes, both to this case and more generally to the treatment of unusual bodies such as Priscilla and Aquila?
I think this tells us that the general sentiment was that such behavior is wrong, that taking the children away from their mother, putting them on show, specifically because they ended up dying in the process, that this was a poor action on Walrin's part. But as a member of the lower gentry who had friends in high places, although certainly not a lot of money, Walrond, he didn't exactly get away with it, but I don't think that he ever was ultimately held responsible for it. He remains in power in Somerset. I'm not exactly sure which years he remained a justice of the peace there, but he certainly still has his family home. He continues acting in the same sort of way in local politics. And if there was a consequence for Walrond, it was not on the legal side of things. Certainly, he was excoriated for his actions. This is made clear. There are three decorative ceramic plates that were created celebrating or memorializing Aquila and Priscilla, and two of those plates are a very clear religious critique of Walrond. In fact, of Sir Edward Phelps, who was also involved in showing the twins. These plates say around the outside, here are two persons that were reconciled to rob the parents and keep the child. Here is Gain o' the Broom in 1680. The Broom or Brome family were confederates of Walrond's in Somerset, and the accusation that Walrond and Phelps had robbed the parents to keep the children seems to have been related to the nonconformist or those individuals who did not belong to the Church of England, to their objections to Walrond acting as the Quaker Whiting said, as a persecutor of Quakers. Walrond was certainly working as a prosecutor of Quakers for not belonging to the Church of England, as they were legally obligated to do. But I believe that those two plates had been created by a Quaker pottery in Brislington outside of Bristol. And so I interpret those plates as being a religious critique of Walrond's actions, both in this specific case and more broadly. He was very disliked among the Somerset Quaker population. And certainly his reputation suffered, but he didn't necessarily have a great reputation in Somerset to begin with, at least not among those who dissented from the Church of England.
Well, the reality of those children's lives scarcely bears thinking about, and indeed the same is true for their parents. But in bringing this heartbreaking case to our attention, you have told us something about the brutal realities of the 17th century. And for that, I thank you. And those who want to know more can pick up a copy of your book, Monstrosity, Bodies and Knowledge in Early Modern England, A Curiosity to See and Behold. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Not Just Tudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.